active Conservative Member of Parliament for Pucklebridge rose. They all waited expectantly.
I don't know what to say, except that I'm very happy and honoured, and I can't wait for a general election.
They all laughed and came forward and surrounded them. Elizabeth dried her eyes before anyone reached her. About an hour later, the chairman accompanied Simon and Elizabeth back to their car and bade them good night. Simon wound down his window.
I knew you were the right man, Milburn said, as soon as Charles Seymour phoned.
Simon smiled.
And warned me to avoid you like the plague.
Could you tell Miss Trumpshaw to come in?
Charles asked his secretary. Margaret Trumpshaw arrived a few moments later and remained standing in front of his desk. She couldn't help but notice the change of furniture in the room. The modern Conran suite had been replaced by a leather club-like sofa. Only the picture of the 11th Earl of Bridgewater remained in place.
Miss Trumpshaw, began Charles, since Mr. Spencer has felt it necessary to resign so suddenly, I think it important for the bank to keep some continuity, now that I'm taking over as chairman.
Miss Trumpshaw stood like a Greek statue, her hands hidden in the sleeves of her dress.
With that in mind, the board has decided to extend your contract with the bank for a further 5 years. Naturally, there'll be no loss in your pension rights.
Thank you, Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Miss Trumpshaw.
Miss Trumpshaw almost bowed as she left the room.
And Miss Trumpshaw?
Yes, Mr. Charles, she said, holding on to the doorknob.
I believe my wife is expecting a call from you. Something about inviting you to lunch at the Savoy Grill?
Chapter 17. A blue shirt, said Raymond, looking at the Turnbull and Asser label with suspicion.
A blue shirt, he repeated.
A 40th birthday present,
shouted Kate from the kitchen.
I shall never wear it, he thought, and smiled to himself.
And what's more, you'll wear it,
she said, her Boston accent carrying a slight edge.
You even know what I'm thinking, he complained as she came in from the kitchen. He always thought how elegant she looked in her tailored office suit.
It's because you're so predictable, Carrot Top.
Anyway, how did you know it was my birthday?
A massive piece of detective work, said Kate, with the help of an outside agent and a small payment.
An outside agent? Who?
The local paper shop, my darling. In the Sunday Times, they tell you the name of every distinguished person celebrating a birthday in the following 7 days. In a week during which only the mediocre were born, you made it. Raymond had to laugh. Now listen, Carrot Top.
Raymond pretended to hate his new nickname.
Do you have to call me by that revolting name?
Yes, I can't stand Raymond.
He scowled. In any case, Carrot Top's a green.
No comment.
Try on your shirt.
Now.
Now.
He took off his black coat and waistcoat and removed his white shirt and eased the stud on his stiff collar, leaving a small circle above his Adam's apple. Curly red hairs stuck up all over his chest. He quickly put on the new gift. The fabric had a pleasant soft feel about it. He started to do up the buttons, but Kate walked over and undid the top two.
You know what? You've brought a whole new meaning to the word uptight.
Raymond scowled again.
But in the right clothes, you could even pass for good-looking.
Now, where should we go to celebrate your birthday?
The House of Commons, suggested Raymond.
Good God, said Kate.
I said celebrate, not hold a wake. What about Annabelle's?
I can't afford to be seen in Annabelle's.
With me, you mean?
No, no, you silly woman. Because I'm a socialist. If members of the Labour Party are not allowed to indulge in a good meal, then perhaps it's time for you to change parties. In my country, one only sees the Democrats in the best restaurants. Now, do be serious, Kate.
I intend to be. Now, what have you been up to in the house lately?
Not a lot, said Raymond sheepishly. I've been snowed under in court, and...
Precisely. It's time you did something positive before your colleagues in Parliament forget you exist.
Have you anything particular in mind?
Asked Raymond, folding his arms across his chest.
As a matter of fact, I have, said Kate. I read in the same Sunday paper as the one in which I discovered your best-kept secret that it's proving difficult for the Labour Party to repeal the Tories' trade union legislation. It appears there are long-term legal implications which the front bench are still trying to find a way around. Why don't you set that so-called first-class mind of yours to working out the legal niceties?
Not such a stupid idea. Raymond had become used to Kate's political sense, and when he'd remarked on it, she had only said, "Just another bad habit I picked up from my ex-husband."
"Now, where do we celebrate?"
she asked.
"Compromise," said Raymond.
"I'm all ears."
"The Dorchester."
"If you insist,"
said Kate, not sounding over-enthusiastic.
Raymond started to change his shirt.
No, Carrot Top. People have been known to wear blue shirts at the Dorchester.
"But I haven't got a tie to match," said Raymond triumphantly.
Kate thrust her hand into the Turnbull and Asser bag and drew out a dark blue silk tie.
"But it's got a pattern on it," said Raymond in disgust. "What will you expect next?"
"Contact lenses," said Kate.
Raymond stared at her and blinked. On the way out of the door, Raymond's gaze fell upon the brightly wrapped package that Joyce had posted from Leeds earlier in the week. He had completely forgotten to open it.
"Damn," said Charles, putting down the Times and draining his coffee.
"What's the problem?"
asked Fiona as she poured out another cup.
"Karslake's been selected for Pucklebridge, which means he's back in the house for life. Obviously my chat to Archie Milburn had no effect."
"Why have you got it in for Karslake?"
asked Fiona. Charles folded the paper and considered the question.
"It's quite simple, really, old girl. I think he's the only one of my contemporaries who could stop me leading the party."
"Why him in particular?"
"I first came across him when he was president of the union at Oxford. He was damn good then, and now he's better. He had rivals, but he brushed them aside like flies. Now, despite his background, Karslake's the one man left who frightens me."
"It's a long race yet, my darling, and he still could stumble."
"So could I. But what he doesn't realize is that I shall be putting out some of his hurdles."
Andrew worded the letter very carefully. He assured Jock McPherson and his colleagues that he'd been flattered by their approach, but explained that he had decided his loyalties were still firmly based in the Labour Party. He accepted the point Jock had made about the left trying to gain control, but felt that every Democratic Party was bound to have a maverick element within its ranks, which was not necessarily unhealthy. He added that he considered the offer to have been confidential on both sides.
"Why add that postscript?"
asked Louise when she had read the letter through.
"It's only fair to Jock," said Andrew. "If it gets around I turned him down, it'll have the opposite effect to the one they were trying to create."
"I'm not so sure they'll act in the same magnanimous way when the next election comes around."
"Ah, Jock will make a lot of noise, but he's all right underneath."
"That isn't what your father says about him," said Louise. "He's sure they'll want revenge."
"Father always sees grubs under even the greenest leaf."
"So if we're not about to celebrate your leadership of the Scottish Nationalists, we'll have to be satisfied with celebrating your 40th birthday. But that's not for at least another month, a week before Robert's 4th birthday."
"How would you like to commemorate the occasion, darling?"
"I thought we might have a week in the Algarve on our own."
"Why don't we have 2 weeks, and then we can celebrate your 40th birthday as well?"
"Andrew Fraser, you've just lost yourself one vote in Edinburgh Carlton."
Simon listened intently to Ronnie's report at the monthly board meeting. Two tenants had not paid their quarterly rent, and another quarter date was fast approaching. Ronnie's solicitors had sent firm reminders, followed a month later by writs, but this action had also failed to elicit any money.
"It only proves what I feared most," said Ronnie.
"What's that?" asked Simon.
"They just haven't got the cash.
So we'll have to replace them with new tenants."
"Simon, when you next travel from Beaufort Street to Whitechapel, start counting the to let signs on office blocks along the way. When you pass 100, you'll find you still haven't reached the city."
"So what do you think we should do about it?"
"Try and sell one of our larger properties to secure cash flow. We can at least be thankful that even at these prices, they're still worth a lot more than our borrowings. It's the companies who are the other way round that have to call in the receiver."
Simon thought about his overdraft, now approaching £100,000, and was beginning to wish he had accepted Ronnie's generous offer to buy back his shares. He accepted reluctantly, but the opportunity had now passed. When the board meeting was over, he drove to St. Mary's to pick up Elizabeth. It was to be one of their three times a week journeys to Pucklebridge, as Simon tried to get round all the villages before Wilson called an election. Archie Milburn was turning out to be a conscientious chairman who had accompanied them on nearly every trip.
"He's been very kind to us," said Elizabeth on their way down.
"He certainly has," said Simon. "Remember, he also has to run Milburn Electronics. But, as he reminds us so often, once he's introduced us to every village chairman, we'll be on our own."
"Have you ever discovered why he and Charles Seymour didn't see eye to eye?"
"No, he hasn't mentioned his name since that night. All I know for certain is that they were at school together."
"So what do you intend to do about Seymour?"
"Not a lot I can do," said Simon, "except keep my eyes very wide open." The man who has deserted Edinburgh once too often. Andrew read the Scottish Nationalist leaflet that had been sent to him that morning by his father. It was full of half-truths and innuendos. Andrew Fraser, the man who has forgotten Edinburgh, should no longer be allowed to represent a Scottish seat. It went on to declare, "He now lives far away from the problems of his constituents in a smart apartment building in fashionable Chelsea among his Tory friends. He visits the city of Edinburgh only a few times a year to make well-publicised appearances. Has being a minister gone to his head?"
"How dare they?" cried Louise in a rage.
Andrew had never seen his wife so angry.
"How dare they come to my home and offer you the leadership of their dreadful little party and then write such a pack of lies? And did you read this?" she added, pointing to the last paragraph.
"His wife, Louise, née Forsyth," she read out loud, "comes from one of the wealthiest families in Scotland. She is a close relation of the owners of Forsyth's in Prince's Street. I'm a second cousin once removed, and they don't even give me a discount in the main store."
Andrew started to laugh.
"What's so funny?"
He took her in his arms.
"I always suffered under the illusion that you would inherit the Forsyth empire, and I would never have to work again," he mocked. "Now we shall have to live off Robert's earnings as a star football player."
"Don't joke, Andrew. It won't seem funny when the election comes round."
"I'm far more concerned about the extreme left trying to infiltrate my general management committee," he said, his voice changing, "than I am by Jock McPherson's band of mad little islanders. But at this moment of time, my red box is too full to worry about either of them."
This ends side two of cassette 5 of First Among Equals. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 6. First Among Equals, cassette 6.
Raymond made such a penetrating speech during the second reading of the new trade union bill that the whips put him on the standing committee, the perfect medium for him to display his skills as the committee debated each clause point by point. He was able to show his colleagues where the legal pitfalls were and how to find a way around them.
The rest of the committee soon learned from Raymond the meaning of mastering a brief, and it was not long before trade union leaders were calling him at the house, and even at his flat, to learn his views on how their members should react to a host of different legal problems. Raymond showed patience with each of them, and more important, gave them excellent professional advice for the price of a phone call. He found it ironic how quickly they chose to forget that he was the author of Full Employment at Any Cost. Snippets began to appear in the national press, ranging from laudatory comments from those involved with the bill to a pointed suggestion in The Guardian that whatever had happened in the past, it would be insupportable if Raymond Gould were not made a member of the government in the near future.
"If they were to offer you a job, would it make any difference to our relationship?" Kate asked.
"Certainly," said Raymond. "I shall have found the perfect excuse not to wear your blue shirts." Harold Wilson held the crumbling edifice together for a further 6 months before finally having to call a general election. He chose the 10th of October, 1974.
Raymond immediately returned to his constituency to fight his fifth campaign. When he met Joyce at Leeds City Station, he couldn't help remembering that his dumpy wife was only 4 years older than Kate. He kissed her on the cheek as one might a distant relative, and then she drove him back to their Chapel Allerton home. Joyce chatted away on the journey home, and it became clear that the constituency was under control, and that this time Fred Padgett was well prepared for a general election.
"He hasn't really stopped since the last one," she said. As for Joyce, she was undoubtedly better organized than the agent and the secretary put together. What was more, Raymond thought, she enjoyed it. He glanced over at her and couldn't help thinking she even looked prettier at election time. Unlike his colleagues in rural seats, Raymond didn't have to make speech after speech in little village halls. His votes were to be found in the high street, where he addressed the midday shoppers through a megaphone and walked around supermarkets, pubs, and clubs, grasping hands before repeating the whole process a few streets away. Joyce set her husband a schedule that allowed few people in the Leeds community to escape him. Some saw him a dozen times during the 3-week campaign, most of them at the football match on the Saturday afternoon before the election. Once the game was over, Raymond was back trooping round the working men's clubs, drinking pint after pint of John Smith's bitter. He accepted it was inevitable that he would put on half a stone during any election campaign. He dreaded what Kate's comments would be when she saw him. Somehow, he always found a few minutes in each day to steal away and phone her. She seemed so busy and full of news, it only made Raymond feel downcast. She couldn't possibly be missing him. The local trade unionists backed Raymond to the hilt. They may have found him stuck up and distant in the past, but they knew where his heart was, as they confided to anyone who would listen. They banged on doors, delivered leaflets, drove cars to polling booths. They rose before he did in the morning, and could still be found preaching to the converted after the pubs had thrown them out at night. Raymond and Joyce cast their votes in the local secondary school on the Thursday of election day, looking forward to a large Labour victory. The Labour Party duly gained a working majority in the House of 43 over the Conservatives, but only 3 over all the parties combined. Nevertheless, Harold Wilson looked set for another 5 years when the Queen invited him to form his 4th administration. The count in Leeds that night gave Raymond his biggest majority ever, 12,207 votes. He spent the whole of Friday and Saturday thanking his constituents, then set out for London on the Sunday evening.
"He must invite you to join the government this time," said Joyce, as she walked down the platform of Leeds City Station with her husband.
"I wonder," said Raymond, kissing his wife on the other cheek. He waved at her as the train pulled out of the station. She waved back enthusiastically.
"I do like your new blue shirt. It really suits you,"
were the last words he heard her say. During the election campaign, Charles had had to spend a lot of time at the bank because of a run on pound. Fiona seemed to be everywhere in the constituency at once,
assuring voters that her husband was just a few yards behind. After the little slips were counted, the swing against Charles to the Labour candidate didn't amount to more than 1% in his 22,000 majority. When he heard the overall result, he returned to London, resigned to a long spell in opposition. As he began to catch up with his colleagues in the House, he found many of them already saying openly that Heath had to go after two election defeats in a row. Charles knew then that he would have to make up his mind once again on where he stood over the election of a new party leader, and that once again he must pick the right man. Andrew Fraser returned to London after a grueling and unhappy campaign. The Scottish Nationalists had concentrated their attack on him, Jock McPherson sailing close to libel and slander. Sir Duncan advised his son against any legal action.
"Only plays into their hands," he warned. "Small parties always benefit from the publicity."
Louise wanted him to inform the press that he had been offered the leadership of the SNP, but Andrew felt it would serve no purpose and might even rebound against him. And he also reminded her that he had given his word. In the last week of the campaign, he spent most of his time trying and failing to stop Frank Boyle, a communist, who had recently moved from Glasgow, from being elected to his general management committee. On polling day, he scraped home by 1,656, Jock McPherson taking second place. At least he looked secure for another 5 years, but it didn't help that the Scottish Nationalists had increased their overall seats in the House to 11. Andrew, Louise and Robert took the plane to London on the Sunday night to find the red box awaiting them and a message that the Prime Minister wanted Andrew to continue as Minister of State at the Home Office. Simon had a glorious campaign. He and Elizabeth had started moving into their new cottage the day the election was announced. Thankful that now she had to commute, her salary at the hospital had made it possible for them to employ a nanny. A double bed and a couple of chairs sufficed as Elizabeth cooked on an old Eger from provisions still packed in tea chests. They seemed to use the same two forks for everything. During the campaign, Simon covered the 200-square-mile constituency for a second time and assured his wife that she need only take the final week off from her duties at St. Mary's. The voters of Pucklebridge sent Simon Carslake back to Parliament with a majority of 18,419, the largest in the constituency's history. The local people had quickly come to the conclusion that they now had a member who was destined to have a cabinet career. Kate kept her remarks very gentle, as it became obvious by the Monday night that the Prime Minister was not going to offer Raymond a job in the new administration. She cooked his favourite meal of roast beef overdone and Yorkshire pudding in the flat that night, but he didn't comment on it and hardly spoke. Chapter 18. After Simon had been back at the Commons for a week, he felt a sense of déjà vu, a feeling that most members returning to the House for a second or even a third time often experience. The sense was heightened by finding everything unchanged, even the policeman who greeted him at the members' entrance. When Edward Heath announced his shadow team, Simon was not surprised that he wasn't included, as he never had been a known supporter of the Tory leader. He was, however, mystified, but not displeased, to discover Charles Seymour was not among the names to be found in the shadow cabinet. "Do you regret turning him down now the full team has been published?" asked Fiona, looking up from her copy of the Daily Mail. "It wasn't an easy decision, but I think it'll prove right in the long run," replied Charles, buttering another piece of toast. "What did he offer in the end?"
"Shadow Minister of Industry."
"Well, that sounds rather interesting," said Fiona.
"Everything about it was interesting, except the salary, which would have been nothing. Don't forget the bank pays me £40,000 a year while I'm chairman."
Fiona folded her paper.
But you've just appointed a full-time chief executive, so your responsibilities at the bank should be only part-time compared with when you took the chair over. So, what's your real reason?
Charles accepted that he could rarely fool Fiona. The truth is that I'm far from certain Ted will be leading the party at the next election.
Then who will if he doesn't?
Asked Fiona. Whoever's got the guts to oppose him. I'm not sure I understand, said Fiona, beginning to clear away the plates. Everyone accepts that he has to allow his name to go forward for re-election now that he's lost twice in a row.
Well, that's fair enough, agreed Fiona.
But as he has appointed all possible contenders to the cabinet or shadow cabinet over the last 10 years, someone he has selected in the past will have to oppose him. No one of lesser stature would stand a chance.
Is there a member of the shadow cabinet willing to stand?
Asked Fiona, returning to her seat at the end of the table.
One or two are considering it, but the problem is that if they lose, it could easily end their political career,
said Charles, folding his napkin.
But if they win,
they will undoubtedly be the next Prime Minister.
Interesting dilemma. And what are you going to do about it?
I'm not supporting anyone at the moment, but I've got my eyes wide open,
said Charles, folding his copy of the Times and rising from the table.
Is there a front-runner? Asked Fiona, looking up at her husband.
No, not really. Will Carslake is trying to rally support from Margaret Thatcher. But that idea is doomed from the start.
A woman leading the Tory party? Your lot haven't got the imagination to risk it, said Elizabeth, tasting the sauce. The day that happens, I shall eat my one and only Tory hat in full view of all the delegates at the party conference.
Don't be so cynical, Elizabeth. She's the best bet we've got at the moment.
But what are the chances of Ted Heath standing down? I always thought the leader of the party stayed on until he was hit by the mythical bus. I don't know Heath very well, but I can never imagine him resigning.
I agree, said Simon. So the 1922 committee will have to change the rules.
You mean the backbenchers will put pressure on him to go?
No, but a lot of the committee in their present mood would be willing to volunteer as driver for that bus.
If that's true, he must realize that his chances of holding on are slim.
I wonder if any leader ever knows that, said Simon.
You ought to be in Blackpool next week, said Kate, resting her elbow on the pillow.
Why Blackpool? Raymond asked, staring up at the ceiling.
Because, Carrot Top, that's where they're holding this year's Labour Party conference.
What do you imagine I could hope to accomplish there?
You'd be seen to be alive. At present, you're just a rumour in trade union circles.
But if you're not a minister or a trade union leader, all you do at a party conference is spend 4 days eating foul food, sleeping in seedy guest houses, and applauding second-rate speeches.
I've no interest in where you put your weary head at night, but I do want you to revive your contacts with the unions during the day.
Why? Said Raymond. That lot can't influence my career.
Not at the moment, said Kate. But I predict that, like my fellow Americans at their conventions, the Labour Party will one day select their leader at the party conference.
Never, said Raymond. That is and will always remain the prerogative of elected members of the House of Commons.
That's the sort of crass, short-sighted, pompous statement I would expect a Republican to make, she said, before plunking a pillow over his head.
Raymond feigned death, so she lifted up a corner and whispered in his ear,
Have you read any of the resolutions to be debated at this year's conference?
A few,
came back Raymond's muffled reply. Then it might serve you well to note Mr. Anthony Wedgwood Benn's contribution, she said, removing the pillow.
What's he up to this year?
He's calling on conference, as he insists on describing your gathering of the brothers, to demand that the next leader be chosen by a full vote of the delegates, making up an electoral college from all the constituencies, the trade union movement and Parliament. I suspect in that order.
Madness! What do you expect? He's married to an American.
Today's extremist
is tomorrow's moderate, said Kate blithely.
A typical American generalization.
Benjamin Disraeli, actually. Raymond placed the pillow back over his head. Andrew always attended the party conference, although he would never have voted for Tony Benn's resolution on the method of selecting a leader. He feared that if the trade unions were given that sort of power, a leader who was totally unacceptable to his colleagues in the House of Commons could be selected. He was relieved when the motion was defeated, but he noted that the majority against was far from overwhelming. Despite being a minister, Andrew could only get a small room at Blackpool, in a guest house masquerading as a hotel, and that some 2 miles from the conference centre. Such were the problems created by 4,000 self-important people converging on a seaside resort for a week, that many had to forego the presidential suite. Andrew still had to carry on his job as Minister of State, with red boxes being delivered and taken every morning and afternoon, while making his presence felt at the conference. He spent half his time on a phone in the hotel lobby, putting through transfer charge calls to the Home Office. No one in the Soviet Union would have believed it, especially if they had realized that the Minister of State for Defense, who had the room next to Andrew's, was pacing up and down the corridor, waiting for the phone to be free. Andrew had never addressed the 3,000 delegates at a party conference. Even cabinet ministers are only allowed a maximum of 10 minutes at the rostrum, unless they're members of the National Executive. Over half the Labour cabinet had failed to be elected to this body, which consisted mainly of the leaders of the larger trade unions. As he left the morning session, Andrew was surprised to find Raymond Gould roaming around, looking lost. They fell on each other like sane men locked in an asylum, and decided to lunch together at the River House, Andrew's favourite restaurant, a few miles outside of Blackpool. Although they had both been in the House for nearly 10 years, it was the first time they discovered how much they had in common. Andrew had never considered himself a close friend of Raymond's, but he'd always admired his stand on devaluation. "You must have been disappointed when the PM didn't ask you to rejoin the government," Andrew began. Raymond stared down at the menu. "Very," he finally admitted, as a girl joined them in the bar to take their order. "Nevertheless, you were wise to come to Blackpool. This is where your strength lies."
"You think so?"
"Come on. Everybody knows you're the trade union's pin-up boy, and they still have a lot of influence as to who sits in the cabinet."
"I haven't noticed," said Raymond mournfully.
"You will when they eventually choose the leader."
"That's funny. That's exactly what Joyce said last week."
"Sensible girl, Joyce. I fear it will happen in our time as members." Bill Scott, the proprietor, told them their table was ready, and they went through to the small dining room.
"Why fear?" asked Raymond as he took his seat.
"Middle-of-the-road Democrats like myself will end up as so many leaves on a bonfire."
"But I'm middle-of-the-road myself. Practically right-wing on some issues."
"Perhaps. But every party needs a man like you. And at this moment, union leaders wouldn't mind if you were a card-carrying fascist. They'd still back you."
"Then what makes you attend the conference?"
"Thank God it still gives one a chance to keep in touch with the grassroots. And I live in hope that the extreme left will never be much more than an unruly child that the grown-ups have to learn to live with."
"Let's hope you're right," said Raymond. "Because they're never going to grow up."
Andrew laughed as Raymond continued in a different mood.
"I still envy you your job at the Home Office. I didn't go into politics to spend my life on the back benches."
"There may well come a day when I sit and envy you from those same back benches," said Andrew. As he spoke, the chairman of the Boilermakers Union shouted across as he passed their table.
"Good to see you, Ray."
He showed no recognition of Andrew. Raymond turned and smiled at the man, and waved back as Caesar might have done to Cassius. When they both rejected the choice of date and walnut pudding, or pavlova, Andrew suggested a brandy. Raymond hesitated.
"You'll see more double brandies drunk here
than you will at the Conservative Party conference next week. Ask any waitress.
Have you decided how you're going to vote in the leadership battle? Asked Fiona over breakfast.
Yes, said Charles. And at this point of my career, I can't afford to make the wrong choice.
So, who have you decided on? Asked Fiona.
While there isn't a serious contender to oppose Ted Heath, it remains in my best interest to continue backing him.
Isn't there one shadow cabinet minister who has the guts to stand against him?
The rumour grows that Margaret Thatcher will act as whipping girl. If she gets close enough to force a second ballot, the serious contenders will then join in.
What if she won the first round?
Don't be silly, Fiona, said Charles, taking more interest in his scrambled egg. The Tory party would never elect a woman to lead them. We're far too traditional. That's the sort of immature mistake the Labour Party would make to prove how much they believe in equality.
Simon was still pushing Margaret Thatcher to throw her hat in the ring.
She certainly has enough of them, said Elizabeth.
It amused Andrew and Raymond to watch the Tory party leadership struggle while they got on with their respective jobs. Raymond would have dismissed Thatcher's chances if Kate hadn't reminded him that the Tories had been the first party to choose a Jewish leader and also the first to select a bachelor.
So why shouldn't they be the first to elect a woman? She demanded.
He would have continued to argue with her, but the damn woman had proved to be right so often in the past.
Let's wait and see, was all he said.
The 1922 committee announced that the election for leader would take place on the 4th of February 1975. At a press conference in early January at the House of Commons, Margaret Thatcher announced she would allow her name to go forward to contest the leadership. Simon immediately spent his time exhorting his colleagues to support the lady, and joined a small committee under Airy Neave that was formed for that purpose. Charles Seymour warned his friends that the party could never hope to win a general election with a woman leading them. As the days passed, nothing became clearer than the uncertainty of the outcome. At 4 o'clock on a particularly wet and windy day, the chairman of the 1922 committee announced the figures. Margaret Thatcher, 130. Edward Heath, 119. Hugh Fraser, 16. According to the 1922 committee rules, the winner needed a 15% majority, and so a second round was necessary.
It'll be held in 7 days' time, the chief whip announced.
Three former cabinet ministers immediately declared they were candidates, while Ted Heath, having been warned that he would get fewer votes a second time round, withdrew from the ballot. They were the longest days in Simon's life. He did everything in his power to hold Thatcher's supporters together. Charles, meanwhile, decided to play the second round very low-key. When the time came to vote, he put his cross on the ballot paper next to the former Secretary of State he had served under at Trade and Industry. A man we can all trust, he told Fiona. When the votes had been counted and confirmed, the chairman of the 1922 committee announced that Margaret Thatcher was the outright winner, with a vote of 146 to 79 from her nearest challenger. Simon was delighted, while Elizabeth hoped he had forgotten about the promise to eat her hat. Charles was dumbfounded. They both wrote to their new leader immediately. 11th of February, 1975. Dear Margaret, many congratulations on your victory as the first woman leader of our party. I was proud to have played a small part in your triumph and will continue to work for your success at the next election. Yours, Simon. 27 Eaton Square, London, SW1, 11th of February, 1975. Dear Margaret, I made no secret of backing Ted Heath in the first round of the leadership contest, having had the privilege of serving in his administration. I was delighted to have supported you
on the second ballot. It illustrates how progressive our party is that we've chosen a woman who will undoubtedly be Britain's next Prime Minister. Be assured of my loyalty. Yours, Charles. Margaret Thatcher answered all her colleagues' letters within the week. Simon received a handwritten letter inviting him to join the new shadow team as number two in the Education Department. Charles received a typed note thanking him for his letter of support.
Chapter 19. Seymour's Bank had weathered the Great War, the 30s crash, and then the Second World War. Charles had no intention of being the chairman who presided over its demise in the 70s. Soon after taking over from Derek Spencer, at the board's unanimous insistence, he had discovered that being chairman wasn't quite the relaxed job he expected, and while he remained confident that the bank could ride the storm, he still wasn't taking any risks. The business sections of the newspapers were full of stories of the Bank of England acting as a lifeboat and having to step in to assist ailing financial institutions, along with daily reports of the collapse of yet another property company. The time when property values and rents automatically increased each year had become a thing of the past. When he had accepted the board's offer, Charles insisted that a chief executive be appointed to carry out the day-to-day business, while he remained the man with whom other city chairmen dealt. He interviewed several people for the position, but didn't find anyone suitable. Headhunting seemed to be the next move, the expense of which was saved when he overheard a conversation at the next table at White's, that the newly appointed chief executive of the First Bank of America was sick of having to report to the board in Chicago every time he wanted to use a first-class stamp. Charles immediately invited the chief executive to lunch at the House of Commons. Clive Reynolds had come from a similar background to Derek Spencer, London School of Economics, followed by the Harvard Business School, and a series of successful appointments, which had culminated in his becoming chief executive of the First Bank of America. This similarity didn't worry Charles, as he made it clear to Mr. Reynolds that the appointee would be the chairman's man. When Reynolds was offered the appointment, he drove a hard bargain, and Charles looked forward to his doing the same on behalf of Seymour's. Reynolds ended up with £50,000 a year and enough of a profit incentive to ensure that he didn't deal for himself or encourage any other headhunters to invite him to join their particular jungle. "He's not the sort of fellow we could invite to dinner," Charles told Fiona, "but his appointment will enable me to sleep at night, knowing that the bank is in safe hands." Charles's choice was rubber-stamped by the board at their next meeting, and as the months passed, it became obvious that the First Bank of America had lost one of its prime assets, well below the market value. Clive Reynolds was a conservative by nature, but when he did take what Charles described as a risk, and Reynolds called a hunch, over 50% of them paid off. While Seymour's kept its reputation for caution and good husbandry, they managed a few quite spectacular coups, thanks to their new chief executive. Reynolds had enough sense to treat his new chairman with respect without ever showing deference, while their relationship remained at all times strictly professional. One of Reynolds' first innovations had been to suggest they check on every customer account over £250,000, and Charles had approved. "When you've handled the account of a company for many years," Reynolds pointed out, "it sometimes isn't apparent when one of your traditional customers is heading for trouble, as it would be to a newcomer. If there are any lame ducks, let's discover them before they hit the ground." A simile that Charles repeated at several weekend parties. Charles enjoyed his morning meetings with Clive Reynolds, as he picked up a great deal about a profession to which he had previously only brought gut feeling and common sense. In a very short time, he learned enough from his new tutor to make him sound like David Rockefeller when he rose to speak in a finance debate on the floor of the House. An unexpected bonus. Charles knew little of Reynolds' private life, except what was on file. He was 41, unmarried, and lived in Esher, wherever that was. All Charles cared about was that Reynolds arrived each morning at least an hour before him, and left after him every night, even when the house was in recess. Charles had studied 14 of the confidential reports on customers with loans over £250,000. Clive Reynolds had already picked out two companies with whom he felt the bank should revise their current position. Charles still had three more reports to consider before he presented a full assessment to the board. The quiet knock on the door, however, meant that it was 10 o'clock, and Reynolds had arrived to make his daily report. Rumours were circulating in the city that the bank rate would go up on Thursday, so Reynolds wanted to go short on dollars and long on gold. Charles nodded. As soon as the announcement had been made about the bank rate, Reynolds continued, "It will be wiser to return to dollars as the new round of pay negotiations with the unions is about to take place. This, in turn, will undoubtedly start a fresh run on the pound." Charles nodded again. "I think the dollar is far too weak at 2.10, Reynolds added. "With the union settling at around 12%, the dollar must strengthen, say to nearer 1.90. He added that he was not happy about the bank's large holding in Slater Walker and wanted to liquidate half the stock over the next month. He proposed to do so in small amounts over irregular periods. "We also have three other major accounts to consider before we make known our findings to the board. I'm concerned about the spending policy of one of the companies, but the other two appear stable. I think we should go over them together when you have time to consider my reports. Perhaps tomorrow morning, if you can manage that. The companies concerned are Spaywood Laboratories, Blackies Limited, and Nethercotton Company. It's Spaywood I'm worried about." "I'll take the files home tonight," said Charles, "and give you an opinion in the morning." "Thank you, Chairman." Charles had never suggested that Reynolds should call him by his first name. Archie Milburn held a small dinner party to celebrate Simon's first anniversary as the member for Pucklebridge. Although these occasions had originally been to introduce the party hierarchy to their new member, Simon now knew more about the constituency and its flock than he did, as Archie was the first to admit. Elizabeth, Peter, and Michael had settled comfortably into their small cottage, while Simon, as a member of the Shadow Education Team, had visited schools, nursery, primary, public, and secondary, universities, red brick, plate glass, and Oxbridge, technical colleges, art institutes, and even Borsals. He had read Butler, Robbins, and Plowden, and listened to children and to professors of psychology alike. He felt that after a year, he was beginning to understand the subject, and only longed for a general election so that he could once again turn rehearsal into performance. "Opposition must be frustrating," observed Archie when the ladies had retired after dinner. "Yes, but it's an excellent way to prepare yourself for government and do some basic thinking about the subject. I never found time for such luxury as a minister."
"But it must be very different from holding office," said Archie, clipping a cigar.
"True. In government," said Simon, "you're surrounded by civil servants who don't allow you to lift a finger or give you a moment to ponder. While in opposition, you can think policy through, even if you do often end up having to type your own letters." Archie pushed the port down to Simon's end of the table.
"I'm glad the girls are out," said Archie conspiratorially, "because I wanted you to know I've decided to give up being chairman at the end of the year."
"Why?" said Simon, taken aback.
"I've seen you elected and settled in. It's time for a younger man to have a go."
"But you're only my age."
"I can't deny that. But the truth is that I'm not giving enough time to my electronics company, and the board are continually reminding me of it. No one has to tell you that these are not easy times."
"It's sad," said Simon. "Just as you get to know someone in politics, you or they always seem to move on."
"Fear not," said Archie. "I don't intend to leave the area, and I feel confident that you'll be my member for at least another 20 years, by which time
I'll be happy to accept an invitation to dine with you in Downing Street.
You may find that it's Charles Seymour who's residing at number 10, said Simon, striking a match to light his cigar.
Then I won't be getting an invitation, said Archie, with a smile.
Charles couldn't sleep that night after his discovery, and his tossing and turning kept Fiona awake. He had opened the Nethercott file when he was waiting for dinner to be served. His first act with any company was to glance down the names of the directors to see if he knew anyone on the board. He recognized no one until his eyes stopped at S.J. Carslake, M.P. The cook felt sure that Mr. Seymour had not enjoyed his dinner because he hardly touched the main course. On his arrival at Seymour's, only moments after Clive Reynolds, he called for his chief executive. He appeared a few minutes later without his usual armful of files, surprised to see the chairman so early. Once Reynolds was seated, Charles opened the file in front of him.
What do you know about Nethercott & Company?
Private company, net asset value approaching £10 million, running a current overdraft of £7 million, of which we service half. Efficiently managed with a good board of directors, will ride out the current problems in my view, and should be well oversubscribed when they eventually go public.
How much of the company do we own?
7.5%. As you know, the bank never take 8% of any company, because then we would have to declare an interest under Section 23 of the Finance Act. It's always been a policy of this bank to invest in a major client without becoming too involved with the running of the company.
Who are their principal bankers?
The Midland.
What would happen if we put our 7.5% up for sale and didn't renew the overdraft facility at the end of the quarter, but called it in instead?
They would have to seek finance elsewhere.
And if they couldn't?
They'd have to start selling their assets, which, under that sort of forced sale position, would be very damaging for any company, if not impossible in the present climate.
And then?
Well, I'd have to check my file and...
Charles passed over the file, and Reynolds studied it carefully, frowning.
They already have a cash flow problem because of bad debts. With a sudden increased demand, they might go under.
I would strongly advise against such a move, Chairman. Nethercott have proved a reliable risk over the years, and I think we stand to make a handsome profit when they're quoted on the stock exchange.
For reasons I cannot disclose to you, said Charles, looking up from his chair, I fear that remaining involved with this company may turn out to be a financial embarrassment for Seymour's.
Reynolds looked at him, puzzled.
We will inform the Midland Bank that we will not be renewing this loan at the next quarter.
Then they would have to look for support from another bank. The Midland would never agree to shoulder in the entire amount on their own.
And try to dispose of our 7.5% immediately.
But that would lead to a crisis of confidence in the company.
So be it, said Charles, as he closed the file. But I do feel...
That will be all, Mr. Reynolds.
Yes, Chairman, said the mystified chief executive, who had never thought of his boss as an irrational man.
He turned to leave.
Had he looked back, he would have been even more mystified by the smile that was spread across Charles Seymour's face.
They've pulled the rug out from under our feet, said Ronnie Nethercott angrily.
Who?
Said Simon, who had just come into the room.
The Midland Bank.
Why would they do that?
An outside shareholder put all his stock on the market without warning, and the Midland got worried about their position. They wouldn't be prepared to continue such a large overdraft position on their own.
Have you been to see the manager? Asked Simon, unable to disguise his anxiety.
Yes, but he can't do anything. His hands are tied by a main board directive, said Ronnie, slumping deeper into his seat.
How bad is it?
They're giving me a month to find another bank. Otherwise, I'll have to start selling some of our assets.
Well, what will happen if we don't manage to come up with another bank? Asked Simon desperately. The company could be bankrupt within weeks. You know any bankers who are looking for a good investment?
Only one, and I can assure you he wouldn't help.
Charles put the phone down, satisfied. He wondered if there was anything that could still be regarded as secret. It had taken him less than an hour to find out the size of Karslake's overdraft. Banker-to-banker confidentiality, he had assured them. He was still smiling when Reynolds knocked on the door. The Midland weren't pleased, he immediately briefed Charles.
They'll get over it, his chairman replied.
What's the latest on Nethercott?
Only a rumour, but everyone now knows they're in trouble, and the chairman is searching around for a new backer, said Reynolds impassively. His biggest problem is that no one is touching property companies at the moment.
Once they've collapsed, what's to stop us picking up the pieces and making a killing?
A clause that was slipped through in the Finance Act, which your government passed 3 years ago. The penalties range from a heavy fine to having your banking license taken away.
Oh, yes, I remember, said Charles.
Pity.
So, how long do you expect them to last?
Once the month is up, said Reynolds, stroking a clean-shaven chin, if they fail to find a backer, the creditors will swarm in like locusts.
Aren't the shares worth anything? Asked Charles, innocently.
Not the paper they're written on at the moment, said Reynolds, watching his chairman carefully. This time, the chief executive couldn't miss the chairman's smile, as Charles thought of Simon Karslake and his overdraft of £108,000, now backed by worthless shares. Pucklebridge would soon be looking for a new member. At the end of a month, during which no bank came to his rescue, Ronnie Nethercott caved in and agreed to call in the receiver and file a bankruptcy notice. He still hoped that he could pay off all his creditors, even if the shares he and his fellow directors held remained worthless. He felt as worried for Simon and his career as he did for himself, but he knew there was nothing the receiver would allow him to do to help one individual. When Simon told Elizabeth, she didn't complain. She had always feared this could be the eventual outcome of her husband joining the board of Nethercott.
Can't Ronnie help? She asked. After all, you've supported him enough in the past.
No, he can't, replied Simon, avoiding telling her where the real responsibility for his downfall lay.
This ends side one of cassette 6. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
But do bankrupts automatically have to leave Parliament? Was Elizabeth's next question.
No, but I shall, because I could never be considered for further promotion. I'd always be rightly tainted with lack of judgment.
It seems so unfair when you weren't personally to blame.
There are different rules for those who wish to live in the spotlight, Simon said simply.
But in time, surely, began Elizabeth.
I'm not willing to remain on the back benches for another 20 years, only to hear whispered in the corner of the smoking room, would have made the cabinet if it hadn't been for...
Does that mean the children will have to be taken away from school?
I'm afraid so, said Simon, his hand shaking. As a bankrupt, I can hardly expect the receiver to view the fees for my son's education as a dire necessity, even if I could find the money.
So we'll have to get rid of the nanny, too.
Not necessarily, but we may both have to make sacrifices in order that she can be part-time.
But my work at the hospital...
began Elizabeth, but didn't complete the sentence.
What happens next?
I'll have to tell Archie Milburn tonight. I've already written my letter of resignation to hand to him. I shall make an appointment to see the Chief Whip on Monday to explain why I'm going to apply for the Chiltern Hundreds.
What does that mean?
It's one of the only ways of leaving the house in mid-session, other than dying. Officially, it's a nominal office under the Crown,
which therefore debars you from membership of the House.
It all sounds rather formal to me.
I'm afraid it will cause an embarrassing by-election in Pucklebridge, Simon admitted.